And indeed it does start right now. A very warm welcome to you to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London with me, Nancy Durham. On the program today, how to start a revolution.
As we speak, somebody is doing it in Iran. As we speak, somebody is doing it in Egypt. As we speak, somebody is doing it in Venezuela. I'm telling you the facts I know.
A group of international journalists in Portugal wrestle with reliable reporting, and a linguist warns the English language is in decline. That's on Midori House over the next 60 minutes. But first, let's get the latest news from around the world with our Nick Kelly. Nick?
Thanks, Nancy. Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Greece's teetering government backed away from a proposed referendum on staying in the euro today, while European leaders talked for the first time of a possible Greek exit to preserve the single currency. Fast-moving events in Athens have overshadowed the first day of the summit of the group of 20 major economies being held in Cannes, with world leaders anxiously urging Europe to take decisive action to halt its sovereign debt crisis. Beleaguered Prime Minister George Papandreou said after an emergency meeting of his socialist cabinet that his call this week for a referendum, which sparked panic on global financial markets, was never a purpose in itself, and he would be happy if the vote were not held. Papandreou said he had agreed to talks with the centre-right opposition on a transitional government to implement a new EU-IMF bailout programme. Early elections would follow. At a torrid meeting in Cannes last night, the French president and German chancellor warned Papandreou that Athens would not receive a cent more in aid until it met its commitments to the eurozone. After the talks, Angela Merkel said Greece had a big decision to make.
We have made it clear once again that the referendum can only concern whether Greece wants to stay in the eurozone, yes or no. And the Greek representatives, including the Greek Prime Minister, have also strongly supported this.
Greece was due to get a vital 8 billion euros instalment this month and says it will run out of money in mid-December if it doesn't get the loan. But European stocks have risen with mounting expectations that Greece's planned referendum on the European Union bailout package will be dropped. President Obama in Cannes for the G20 summit said that the financial crisis is firmly on the agenda.
We also discussed the situation in Greece and how we can work to help resolve that situation as well. And the United States will continue to be a partner with the Europeans to resolve these challenges.
The Greek finance minister, Evangelos Venizelos, called on the Greek government to categorically rule out a referendum on a crucial bailout plan and do everything to implement the deal. Venizelos had initially backed the referendum, but later broke ranks with his prime minister, arguing that it was not what Greece needed at this time. These members of the public on the streets of Athens say they want the Greek prime minister to resign.
Well, of course I believe that Mr. Papandreou should quit today, the soonest possible, because he's not serious anymore. He's joking, and that's a bad joke.
I think yes, I'm positive in because in this situation, it's nothing else he can do. And I support that a cooperation between the parties is the best solution.
At the G20 meeting, Europe and the US will be looking to China to help solve the world's financial woes and contribute to the Eurozone's bailout fund. Western countries also want Beijing to revalue its currency and boost consumer spending to help get the global economy moving again. Li Fenyung, editor of the Financial Times in China, says the government may be reluctant to step in.
China would say that get your house in order first before asking any help. And secondly, it is a domestic issue which Chinese government has to actually sell the idea to its people.
Finally, Syria must quickly implement the commitments it made to the Arab League to end violence and allow opposition groups to operate. The European Union said today at the G20 summit that Syria had agreed to the plan. But today, 10 people were killed in Homs, and there was no sign yet of troops leaving urban areas. The Qatari Prime Minister, Sheikh Hamid bin Jassim Al Thani, who leads the Arab League committee behind the plan drawn up in Cairo last night, explained what the Syrian delegation has agreed to.
Firstly, a halt to all acts of violence to protect the Syrian civilians. Secondly, the release of all political prisoners and the withdrawal of all tanks, armored vehicles from the streets. And finally, to allow journalists, rights groups and the Arab League representatives to monitor the situation in Syria.
Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Nick. Nick Kelly. Now for a global weather forecast, we turn to Tomasz Szafranacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
Well, normally this time of the year in European countries, we get the first blasts of snow, especially in Eastern Europe and more especially in Scandinavia. At the moment, such is the extent of the mild weather that even around the European Arctic Circle, it's too warm for snow. And that really is something for early November. Now, after a mild day today, Thursday, in many European cities, on Friday, again, we can expect very mild weather, highs of up to 17 degrees across much of France, 10 to 12 degrees at least in southern Scandinavia. And in terms of the weather itself, again, Spain, France and the UK, further rain, which is expected to reach Switzerland, Italy and much of the Western Mediterranean. So here's your city forecast then for tomorrow, that's Friday. Helsinki, 9 degrees and cloudy. In Stockholm, 10 Celsius, also cloudy. Berlin, a bit warmer at 13, some sunshine here. Zurich, also 13, cloudy with a chance of rain. And in London, 17 degrees with spells of rain right into the weekend. Now on to air travel. The story is very similar to what it has been in the past 24 hours. A lot of poor weather across Western Europe, weather fronts and the jet stream here. Friday's westbound flights to the United States and Canada will be mostly calm if you're just flying over Greenland. Then over into Canada, the jet stream giving more of a headwind, some turbulence around too. So let's head to North America now, and we'll start with the eastern seaboard. And after some good weather through Thursday, all the way from Florida along the east coast to Long Island and New England, changes are on the way. Clouds are on the increase and rain is expected during Friday from North Florida to the Carolinas and possibly into Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, it's already raining in Chicago, many of the central states getting the soggy weather for the end of the week. Even northern parts of California will have some showers. So the city forecast then into Thursday and Friday. San Francisco, some showers on the way, 15 degrees here. Los Angeles, also 15 with a shower. Chicago, a wet Thursday, but a sunny Friday on the way, highs of 11. And in New York City, staying sunny here, the temperature also 11 degrees. Air travel, most of the bumpy weather across the US will be over the northeastern states of Pennsylvania into New York State during Friday, the jet stream giving you a bit of a kick here. And if you're flying from JFK to Heathrow, you'll be riding that jet stream, a good tailwind and a faster journey to Europe. And quickly into the Asia Pacific region, the outlook for Friday, South Korea and Seoul, a chance of showers and thunderstorms all through the weekend, highs of 20 degrees. In Japan, Osaka and Tokyo, fair weather here with some sunshine and highs of 22 to 25. And finally, China and Hong Kong, sunny and warm at 29 degrees. That's it. I'm meteorologist Tomasz Szafranacker here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and here in London and most places around the world, it's just about 9 minutes past the hour. In a moment, we're off to Portugal to get the latest Journo news buzz.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 podcast, yeah.
Monocle 24, Yorkshire.
This is Monocle 24.
Tämä on Monocle 24. The Blue
Pajalabat. Monocle 24.
This is 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 Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
The 10th Annual News Exchange Conference is underway in Cascais in Portugal. It's billed as the news industry's most provocative and most insightful conversation. Wow. Well, one of the talkers around the table there at the beautiful seaside port of Cascais is Thomson Reuters head of multimedia, Greg Beitzman. Hello, how are you?
I'm pretty well. I wish I could say it was really beautiful. It's actually raining quite heavily.
We sent that. We sent that to you.
Thank you.
Hey, Greg, thanks for joining us. Appropriately, as head of multimedia, your session's been concentrating on how to reliably use social media for content. Have you figured out a way to do that?
Well, I think no. We haven't exactly figured out a way to do it. But what we are understanding is that it's absolutely a part of our universe and that it isn't just about sourcing content for our audiences that we serve as the media. It's also about, you know, serving those sources. And I think when we begin to think about the relationships that change or that evolve out of that, the entire sort of fundamentals of who we are changes. It's a bit existential.
It is a bit sounding that way. Can you give us a little concrete example here of what you're talking about?
Well, I think, one way of looking at it is that we talk about bits of content that we might pull off of social media. We at Reuters, for example, we've pulled all kinds of video footage out of the Arab Spring, actually beginning with Iran, in fact, the uprising there 2 years ago. We began to source quite a bit of video content from Iran. And then, of course, everything that's happened from Tahrir Square, from Tunisia on, much of what we've done has been supplemented by social media. You know, the real question is, first of all, people publishing on social media, all of them care about the same topic. There is a bit of an echo chamber that goes on when you begin to source content from social media. And is that okay for an industry that I think has for a long time prided itself on being objective? That entire value proposition is changing. What the value of objectivity versus, for example, the value of transparency is, I think, where the shift is going. You know, is it important to be absolutely balanced, or is it more important to be honest about who you are? These are the kinds of questions, I think, that we were talking about today.
Just to pick up on transparency, it's one of those great words, isn't it? And are you referring to when we were saying, look, we've got this off such and such a cell phone somewhere in the world. We think it's this. We don't know for sure. We're being open with you. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, I think that's one sort of level of transparency, a pretty simple way of looking at it. But there's also acknowledgement that, look, you know, you're covering an event via social media and understanding that that inherently has a kind of bias attached to it. Because, you know, it's not like we're out there getting many tweets from Assad. We're getting a lot of tweets from the people in the streets of Syria. But, you know, we do have a sort of, by the traditional standard, a kind of unobjective sort of reporting going on. We need to be open about that.
Okay, and we need some sort of rule book to go with that too, I presume.
Yeah, I think rule books are going to be really tough to evolve. Things are happening much faster than any sort of rule book, than any sort of rule book we could formulate. It's really interesting. One of the questions we asked the audience was, you know, should we change the definition of who's a journalist? And interestingly, many, many people came back and said, no, we shouldn't. And that's despite the fact that so much content about all these stories in the last year in the Middle East are really coming out of non-journalists. The next question we asked was actually, do we think media changes as a result of these social media, just who we are change? And actually the answer there was yes. So I think we got some of the way in kind of establishing the sort of depth of change that's required as you begin to interact with this kinds of information and data.
Yes, and where do you stand on the journalist who is a journalist question? Because as you've just put it, non-journalists are breaking news. They are putting the stories out there. Do you have a difficult time saying, well, no, we can't call you a journalist?
I think it's pretty clear to us that we can't print licenses to be journalists. I was at a conference earlier this summer that we organized post the Murdoch scandal, and there was one proposal being floated around the audience that we ought to have, you know, journalism permits. It's just completely impossible and out of date. It's a little bit like an orchestra playing on the deck of the Titanic as it goes down. It's just not at all relevant to the environment we're in. The reality is everyone can be a journalist. If you define journalism as the ability to witness an event and then publish content about that event to an audience, that's just not something that's limited to anybody special anymore. So the question was a provocation to a degree to our audience, but in a way, maybe it's unfair because it's just irrelevant now.
What do we do when mistakes are made? I don't want to pick on you at Reuters. We've all made mistakes, but I think Reuters has had one or two. Like, what do you do when you put the wrong picture out there?
You know, transparency. We had a scenario last year with a photograph that we published out of that Turkish ship that was going to Gaza, and we, a stringer there, cut pieces of the picture out. He didn't sort of edit the picture content itself, but he just removed a bloody knife from it. We had to be very open and upfront about the fact that, a picture of an Israeli soldier did have a bloody knife in it, but somebody removed it, and I think in an attempt to make it look less favorable for the Israeli soldier. These are the kinds of things, you know, look, all we can do is be as transparent as possible, be as honest as possible. I think the universe, there's enough content out there now that no one is considered to be sort of Bible of, you know, of facts, and people can now accept that mistakes are made. Addressing that quickly is really important. If you want to build loyalty with an audience, if you're trying to tell a story, being transparent with them, being honest with them is 100% important.
Where is it the most difficult to deal with all this flood of information? Is it live TV? I'm thinking of that motto, never wrong for long. but when you have all kinds of information coming at you, let's take Gaddafi. Remember the picture of him dead that turned out not to be him dead, and then later we saw the real dead pictures. Live television is really at risk here, I think.
Well, I mean, one of the examples that came up in our conversation was about the Osama bin Laden, killing in May, and someone pointed out that they were watching live television, and people were sort of alluding to something happening in a foreign country. It might be Pakistan. Oh, it's probably Afghanistan. This person who's working at a network actually turned to Twitter and began to see tweets out of that guy in Abbottabad, which is where the Osama bin Laden compound was, tweeting about helicopters overhead.
Yeah.
And actually got much more information that way via social media platforms than they did via traditional media. I think that even television is coming off slow if you compare it to what's available on something like Twitter.
Could I jump in and ask you about, I hear that the National Public Radio's man, Andy Carvin, has been at a session there talking about how he's become a one-man news agency by having all his thousands of Twitters twittering to him and then verifying information for him. It sounds a bit bizarre to me.
Well, I mean, Andy Carver is certainly here, and he spoke at length about whether or not the Arab Spring was really a result of Twitter, pointing out that, social media 1.0 would just be slips of paper passed under people's doors and encouraging them to come and participate in a protest. So I think, we all understand that it's not so much the medium, it is actual sentiment, it is people wanting change, but obviously they'll take advantage of whatever media is available at the time to drive that change. In terms of what people can do with Twitter, you can now go and edit out your own personal news agency. When I was in Japan covering the tsunami earlier this year, I was getting a huge amount of information simply by following people on Twitter. Much more than I was getting internally at Reuters, much more than I would get from watching NHK. There is no doubt about it. It is within the fingertips now of many, many users
to create
that kind of experience.
Sorry, Greg, were you in Japan at the time?
I went to Japan just after the tsunami. Flew out the day of the disaster, and was there for a couple of weeks.
And do you carry on using Twitter while you're on the scene?
While I was on the scene, I found Twitter to be extremely good at giving me information from Japanese media, which people were watching and putting out on Twitter. And I found it very good for receiving information from people like the U.S. Embassy, people like the Japanese government spokesman, people who I felt were valuable. And I quickly assembled a list of people to follow and picked up some from people like Storyful, who do this a similar sort of model. Storyful goes out and discovers who's sort of reliable and relevant on particular stories, and then curates that into a feed. You can pull their feed, or you can go and build it yourself.
Which
it's very quick and easy to do.
Yeah, which surely every reporter would rather do. Otherwise, it sort of feels a bit like working in a TV newsroom, ripping and reading wire copy, right?
I think that's one of the things we tried to cover today was, look, you can get a lot of real-time information off of Twitter. You can get a lot of real-time information off of the Internet. Is that the same as really good quality journalism? I think that what's changed now is, real-time news, there is no such thing as exclusivity. It's just about who had facts first, which is a very little value to people. Where this is going, I think, is, and I think one of the conclusions we reached is, high-quality journalism will have to really stand out. It will have to be very high quality. It's no longer sufficient to write, rain is falling in Qashqai because of storm clouds, or something very simplistic along those lines. That's available already. Journalism, which is going to attract eyeballs and retain eyeballs, needs to be very high quality and needs to be transparent, building loyalty with those audiences.
Great.
Otherwise, facts are just not enough.
Great. Thank you very much. Bring it on. We're waiting for the quality journalism. Greg Beichmann in Portugal, thank you very much.
Welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Every week, Monocle editor Andrew Tuck looks at cities around the world and the people, buildings and open spaces that make up the urban landscape. With interviews and discussions of the spaces and places we live in, The Urbanist is your very own urban audio retreat. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24, and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and, of course, on iTunes.
For listeners in Tokyo or visitors to Japan, you can now enjoy a coffee, a Wilkinson dry ginger ale, or our classic curry at our first ever Monocle cafe and shop at the new Hankyu Men's Department Store, just steps from Ginza and the lobby of the peninsula. Featuring a Monocle shop, stocked with our ever-expanding collection of special collaborations, the Monocle Cafe is the perfect place to refuel after a run round the Imperial Palace or a busy day in Marunouchi. For more details, visit monocle.com.
Next, the English language in decline. First this.
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear words they're saying. Only the echoes of my mind.
Well, Harry Nilsson evidently can't hear a word they're saying. And if Niklas Östler is right, there's lots more misunderstanding ahead. The distinguished linguist, chair and chairman of the Foundation of Endangered Languages, believes the English language is at serious risk. His latest book is The Last Lingua Franca. The author talked with Monocle correspondent Amy Gutman.
You start out by constructing a rather bold, slightly provocative theory, which is that it's not a question of if, but rather when the English language will decline. Tell me about that.
Languages are never neutral. There's a fashion now to think that if English is turning into globish, it ceases to be the language of the British and the Americans and the Australians and begins to be something that everybody has in their background. But looking at the languages of the past, there's never been a one that did not have its past written all over it. Latin, perhaps, would be a good example of a language which seemed to be independent of its past, since it was cut loose from the Roman Empire and became the language of the Roman Catholic Church. Nevertheless, people just weren't interested in it when they felt they could get away with something else.
What would stop English from being useful? I mean, it is the common language throughout the world. It's hard to imagine, if not English, what?
Well, it's also been the language of the people who've dominated world trade and production for the last century and a half. Let's put it where it is today. And the fact is, as it's no longer a secret, that the British and the Americans and others who are naturally connected with the English language are not going to be calling the shots for very much longer.
But I'm just curious about that. So, okay, if we're talking about who's calling the shots, China is a major player these days, so let's use them as an obvious example. They're already teaching children in their schools and have for decades. It's hard to imagine them stopping all of a sudden and saying, hang on, wait a minute.
Well, I don't know how universal the next languages are going to be. I think of English as the last lingua franca because I think it's the last language which needs to be learned in order to do global trade. I think technology is going to make a big difference to the usability of multilingualism in the future. But it is certainly the case already that the Chinese, when they are surveyed, are getting less interested, it seems, or less, thinking it's less vital to learn English. They're beginning to realize that, in fact, other people will need to come to them.
You also make the point that by 2050, there won't be any one common language. What language would they then learn? What would you suggest?
Well, I'm not sure that I'm in the business of suggesting which language people should learn. All languages are great fun to learn. You get a lot out of them. I'm currently trying to learn Guarani, which is not one of the better known languages in the world, but it has a cache of ancient culture that is not well known. So I would encourage people to learn languages for what they can learn through those languages. what is increasingly going to be the case is that if you just want to know to communicate with other people in the world, you're going to be able to speak your own language and rely on technology to support it.
What have you found to be the hardest language to learn?
Well, in my case, it's been Irish, the language of the island closest to Britain, where I grew up. It's hard because it's very difficult to hear the differences between different words. Ban is a different word from ban. One is women, the other is woman. And those sort of differences, which the Irish seem to think are perfectly straightforward, are very, very subtle. And what's more, even having learnt other languages where it supposedly have comparable distinctions, such as Russian, there's just no compromise. They make them in a different way. They heard in a different way. Another thing is that I distinguish languages between ones where you can understand parts of a sentence before you understand the whole thing, and languages where you have to get it all or nothing. French is a language of the second sort. German or Italian are languages of the first sort. You can hear bits and gradually put it together. Irish is very much a language of the sort where you get it all or nothing at all.
The very interesting Nicholas Osler talking there with Monocle correspondent Amy Gutman. Now, perhaps appropriately, a song by Coldplay called Talk. We're at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24's Midori House. I'm Nancy Durham, and in the next half hour, we'll learn how to start a revolution and keep it peaceful. First, the news headlines with Nick Kelly.
Thanks, Nancy. Greece's teetering government backed away from a proposed referendum on staying in the euro today, while European leaders talked for the first time of a possible Greek exit to preserve the single currency. Prime Minister George Papandreou has said he would scrap a referendum on Greece's bailout lifeline if the Conservative opposition agreed to back the package in Parliament. Syrian security forces killed 10 people in Homs today, activists said, and there's no sign yet of troops leaving cities under an Arab League agreement to end bloodshed after 7 months of protests against President Bashar al-Assad. Israel staged a mass drill today, simulating a missile attack in the centre of the country at a time of intense speculation that the Jewish state could launch strikes on Iran, although the military dismissed any link. Pressure rose on Italy's besieged Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi to quit today as six former parliamentary loyalists called for a new government and the squabbling cabinet failed to agree on urgent economic reforms. A French satirical weekly whose office was firebombed after it printed a cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad has reproduced the image with other caricatures in a special supplement distributed with one of the country's leading newspapers. NATO vowed today to put severe military pressure on the Haqqani military network, suspected of being behind recent attacks on Western troops in Afghanistan. Somali Islamist militants mounted weapons on roofs, dug trenches and armed students in the port of Kismayu, warning the Kenyan invasion would lead to cataclysmic consequences. And pirates have hijacked an oil products tanker off the coast of Nigeria after contact was lost with the vessel and crew over the weekend. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Nick. And this is Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Nancy Durham. And I'm delighted to be joined at this point by our senior editor, Sophie Grove.
Hello, Nancy.
Hi, Sophie. How are you doing?
Great, thank you.
Bringing me a little weather report from outside, just our little corner here. Bit of rain out there still?
Well, yes, it's hammering with rain last time I looked.
Thank you very much for that impromptu little freebie. Okay, and we're going to have an interesting chat coming up, and I think you know something about it. I wanted to steer us in the direction. I think we are hoping to have someone with us soon on the line. And the way I was going to get into this next story was to ask, do you live in a happy country? And if you do, there's a chance you've never heard of or had to call on the help of Gene Sharp. He's an octogenarian American political theorist and a world authority on how to wage nonviolent revolutions. And that's why they do know who he is in places like Burma, Georgia, the Balkans, and yes, of course, right across the Middle East. Some call him the architect of the Egyptian uprising. And British filmmaker Rory Arrow thinks we ought to all know a bit more about this man. And to that end, he's made a documentary called How to Start a Revolution. I guess you've heard about this, Sophie.
Yes, well, it's fascinating. I mean, this is really a guidebook, a handbook, 198 tenets, and they're everything we've seen in the Arab Spring. It's, you know, colours, symbols, putting your women and children at the front, putting up signs in English. All of this advice is in the book, and it's fascinating to see that you know, these things have been written down and maybe even distributed, you know, in the protests. So Rory, the director, has kind of been around and really investigated this, the life and of this book and how much influence it really had.
Okay. And the film that Rory Arrow has made of this, How to Start a Revolution, has been winning awards, I think, right and left at film festivals since its premiere just in September.
Sounds like it. I think it won something at Raindance, and it's the Copenhagen Documentary Festival. It's going to be there. So it's really making a little bit of noise in the sort of film world. And it's a fascinating, very arresting film. And he goes all around the world. So it'd be interesting to speak to him.
Well, and in the spirit of revolutionary glasnost, dear listener, we had a little bit of trouble getting him on the line, but he is there now. But first, we're going to just play a little snippet of sound from Rory's film, How to Start a Revolution.
As we speak, somebody is doing it in Iran. As we speak, somebody is doing it in Egypt. As we speak, somebody is doing it in Venezuela. I'm telling you the facts I know.
To be counted as a threat to a tyrant is a matter of pride, I would say. It means we're effective. It means we're relevant. It means out of this very small office, we produce work that threatens regimes.
Gene Sharp's tactics and theories are being practiced on the streets of Syria as we speak now.
It shows that what Gene was talking about year after year after year, there are realistic alternatives to violent conflict.
Unless they have something instead of violence and war, they will go back for violence and war every time.
Wow. Hello, Rory. Are you there?
I am.
Great to hear that trailer from your film. Can we jump in first with some words about Gene Sharp? He sounds or seems to be quite an unlikely revolutionary. He's an academic just doing his work. Tell us about him.
That's right. He's an 83-year-old ex-Harvard University academic who's really kind of written the book on how you undermine dictatorships. And he's written a sort of strategic guideline for how you do this. And it's really sort of composed of all the techniques from history of occasions where people have used nonviolent forms of struggle to help undermine tyranny of many different kinds.
And have the revolutionaries of the past decade or so been running around with his big book under their arm, or how do they find out about him?
Well, they have, and it's not a very big book, actually. It's more like a small pamphlet type book. It's called From Dictatorship to Democracy. It's an extract from a bigger book which he wrote in 1973, and it's really been used in pretty much every single revolution of the past sort of couple of decades, really. And it's really just passed from hand to hand on recommendation from revolutionary group to revolutionary group, probably starting in Serbia. It was used to help bring down President Milosevic. And then it was passed to the Central Europeans, people like the Ukrainians during the Orange Revolution and the Georgians. And then from there on to Egypt and Syria, which we've seen this year going on then.
So did someone pop a little pamphlet into your hand when you were out there covering the wars?
No, I didn't see the pamphlet, but what I did see was extracts from the work translated into Arabic in the publications that the groups were circulating in Tahrir Square while I was there.
And also the Muslim Brotherhood itself, which you wouldn't normally associate with kind of liking Americans, had it on their website to download. Mohammed El Baradei's group, a political group, was distributing it, and also the Democratic sort of student groups. So three very different groups who you wouldn't normally think would associate with each other had all found the work independently.
Well, fascinating. Sophie Grove, our senior editor, is here with us. Sophie, come on in.
Hi, Rory.
Hi.
I just wanted to ask you, I mean, is this something of a vindication for Gene? It sounds like he's had a bit of a tough time with accusations that he was in the CIA, and you know, he really has struggled. And now the Arab Spring is sort of showing that all of his points are kind of really the right recipe.
Yes, I think what you see in the press, these CIA attacks tended to come, they're around sort of 2004, 2005, and this is when a lot of his work was being used in sort of countries like Ukraine, where they were being used against sort of almost in pursuit of U.S. foreign policy interests, in that those countries were countries that the U.S. would have liked to have seen a change. And, of course, then he got accused of being a kind of agent of the state. But it's quite clear now that his work is being used in Arab states that are not actually like Egypt. You know, in the U.S. foreign policy objective for regime change, to countries that are actually quite friendly. So it just shows that for years and years, his work has been used by lots of revolutionary groups. He has seen all of the successes himself. But I think probably it hasn't been known to a wider public just how dispersed his writings have become and how useful they are to people, not just in bringing down dictatorships, but of winning smaller rights in human rights and environmental rights in within countries all over the world.
And it sounds like the pamphlet's gone viral, to put it mildly, but who did he write it for in the first place? Was there a specific target audience?
Well, originally he wrote From Dictatorship to Democracy for the Burmese groups who'd been exiled after Aung San Suu Kyi had been jailed. And he was asked to go to Burma, and he was teaching a little bit of nonviolent struggle in rebel camps, these sort of paramilitary camps, because he wanted to show them that, you know, there was an alternative to violent conflict. So they asked him to write a book for them on how to get rid of a dictatorship nonviolently. But what he said was, "I don't know anything about Burma, really. I'm not a specialist on Burma." But so what he did was to try and create a generic book on the general principles on how they could bring down a dictatorship. And that weakness of not really knowing Burma well ended up being the strength of the book, because he wrote generic analysis that could be used in any country in the world, and therefore it was passed from hand to hand and people could see strengths in it in all sorts of different movements.
And Rory, can you tell me a bit about the making of the documentary? Where did you go and what did you see? Did you see his legacy all over the place?
Yes, I was a newspaper reporter initially, and that's when I first saw Gene Sharp's work in action. I was covering some of these revolutions in sort of Central Europe, and I noticed that they were using a lot of the same tactics. And at first I thought it might have been a CIA conspiracy myself, but when I looked closer, the people that I talked to said that they were using this book. So I'd already seen it sort of in action in a couple of these revolutions before I started the film. And then I started the film in 2009. And this was clearly before the Arab Spring and before the Iranian Green Uprising in 2009. In fact, that just happened a matter of days after I returned from the first interview. So the film has kind of grown with sort of, you know, current events. And, I just followed all of the revolutionary groups who had passed that book from hand to hand, and so the leaders from the current revolutions in Egypt and Syria, to find out how they were using it and how relevant it was to their struggle.
You know, there's a would-be revolution parked outside St. Paul's Cathedral. They're in California, New York, all around the world. Is he charting this current popular movement? And are any of those protesters following his handbook? Do you know?
Yes, I've been to visit several of the Occupy movements, including the one in Boston. And yes, they are very interested in his work. and you'll see his books in there. You know, there's always an Occupy library at most of these protests as well. And From Dictatorship to Democracy is definitely the books in there. So it's obviously of interest to them. I think they have a more interesting style in that they don't seem to be strategically inclined at the moment. I think that might change over the coming months as they kind of read more and more of his work.
Do you think we could, well, but we don't know where they're going in their heads and what their strategy is, but do you think we could have a kind of pragmatic lesson from you? If you took his guidebook, how would you start a revolution? What would be the top tips?
Well, I think it's for him to give you the top tips, but I can say that the most important thing is overcoming fear, and that's clearly happened. Overcoming fear.
Yeah.
But the second most important thing, or it could be the most important really, is to have a strategy, to have an idea, an objective of what you want to gain, because at the moment they're in the streets, but they've got no sense of what someone would have to do in order for them to leave the streets. And they seem to have been sort of clinging to this idea that by clearly holding ground, holding a square somewhere for as long as possible, that's going to win some sort of concession. But that's not going to win any sort of concession at all. Protest alone is weak. And you need to combine many of these different methods, which are outlined in Gene Sharp's books. The really powerful things are things like economic boycotts, strikes, and just convincing the people who you want to, who you need to change their minds to make policy decisions. But the problem is because they don't have a clear objective which they've articulated, it's very hard for them to make moves towards that. But the strategy is absolutely key, and that's what they don't seem to have at the moment.
And this, he has a list of, I think, 198 sort of what to do, colors, symbols. He uses graphics, banners, mock funerals.
Yeah, and these things, you're not really being seen. You know, protest is a single one of those non-violent weapons. And what you kind of gain from reading Gene Sharp's book is it's a bit like a military campaign. You have to wage it like that. If you put 100,000 soldiers on the battlefield without a bullet ban, they're going to be pretty useless. And Gene Sharp says, well, it's the same is true of protests. If you put 100,000 protesters in the streets and they just sit there for months upon months and don't do anything, then they're not going to really achieve the objective that they set out to achieve. So you've really got to think about it more strategically, more powerful means of waging this struggle. And those are the things that are outlined in the book.
Hi, it's Sophie again. I just wanted to ask you, I mean, what does Gene recommend, you know, in Bahrain or Iran, we've seen uprisings, but they're not revolutions. What's his advice to those people who've done everything he said in his handbook, but it hasn't worked?
Well, again, I can't speak for Gene Sharp because he's got an incredibly, you know, encyclopedic knowledge of past struggles. And also he doesn't give direct advice on specific countries, because he just says, you know, I don't know your country. I've written a generic analysis. You have to read this. You have to study it very carefully and take the lessons that you can apply. But my personal opinion on countries like Bahrain, again, is that these struggles take a very long time. They need people in the democratic movements to really study this work. And you can't expect to win the struggle overnight. And things like Syria, you know, one of the final lessons in the film is don't give up. You know, the Egyptian democracy activists were first in Gene Sharp's office in 2005 and 2006. So that's, you know, 6 years since they were first contacting Gene. So these things take a long time. They need to, the most powerful things they need to do are to win over the police and the army and all of these institutions which hold up the government. And they need to identify a strategy for kind of converting each of those pillars of support of that government over to the democratic side. And that just doesn't happen overnight.
Rory, tell us where we can see your film. You've been winning awards. Where is it playing next? A couple of places in the world you'd like to name?
Yeah, well, it's playing in London at the Frontline Club on the 9th of November, Sunday the 9th of November at 4 p.m. You can get tickets from the Frontline Club. It's playing in Copenhagen, CPH, Docks and Florence. And those are the next ones on the film festival scale. And then it will be on Current TV on the 1st of January at 2012.
Well done, you. We look forward to seeing it. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks very much.
Rory Arrow, whose film How to Start a Revolution is making the rounds and making a big hit. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. I'm Nancy Durham. I'm here with Sophie Grove.
You can now download Monocle's first app featuring our Monocle 24 radio player, daily monocolumn feed, and our global 25-25 city guide series. With its unique time shift device to spool through programs, you can either listen live or catch up on anything you might have missed via our archive. The Monocle app, available from the end of October via iTunes, is brought to you in association with Rolex.
Every Saturday, Monocle's editors team up with a lively mix of guests to take a leisurely look back at the week past and pull out their personal highlights, cultural, political, musical, cinematic, and more. Our Saturday show is the perfect accompaniment to the weekend papers and a good coffee. The Review comes to you in association with J. Crew every Saturday at 11 a.m. London time, right here on Monocle 24, and is also available on our timeshift player on monocle.com and on iTunes.
Well, it's lovely to have you here in Midori House this evening inside Monocle 24 Studio 1. I'm Nancy Durham. And lost in the news from Greece, to some extent anyway, was this week's sacking of the country's top military leaders. It's getting pretty hard to follow the plot, which is why we called Pepe Egger of the London-based consultancy Exclusive Analysis. Events are unfolding, change is happening so quickly in Greece. What's going on?
This is a very fast-moving situation. Papandreou was reported to have offered his resignation today. Then they denied that he had offered his resignation. He offered a government of national unity, and that's where we are now. The referendum would then be dropped, but this is not finalized yet, I would think.
Okay, and then just to take us back to a little bit earlier in the week, you know, what does it mean that the heads of the Army, Navy, and Air Force were all shoved out just like that?
Yes. I would think very unlucky, because basically doing it at this moment in time just sends all the wrong signals.
But exactly why would they do it then?
Well, everybody is looking at Greece. Everybody is trying to read the situation. And then do it at this moment, you're bound to have a lot of people starting to ask questions. What does this mean? I mean, Greece had a coup in 1967, and in not very distant past. So what does it mean? I would think that it doesn't have anything to do with the coup at all. Essentially, what happens is that it's the prerogative of a government to appoint such leadership, right? And of course, a Papandreou government would want to make such appointments. For me, the fact that they have done it now is an indication that Papandreou himself was now really starting to get worried that his government will not survive into next week. That's mainly to do with the vote of confidence that was scheduled and is now again or still scheduled for Friday.
So by changing the military men at the top, he might have been able to put more friendly forces there for him?
No, but if you lose the vote of confidence, then you can't appoint anybody anymore because you're out of office. I.e., if he loses the vote of confidence, then there are early elections with his almost certain to lose, and therefore he couldn't make these appointments any longer. So in a way, the fact that he made them now was a sign that he was worried not to be there anymore next week, and therefore not to be able to make such appointments any longer. So this was a sort of last minute, I want to appoint some of my guys for the top jobs in the army before I'm out.
Right, and that's what I was suggesting. He has friendlier forces in there than perhaps last week. Correct?
Yeah, even though, you know, these appointments, I don't think we should overread their significance in the sense that, yes, Greece is in a situation of high civil unrest, increased political polarization, a lot of anger amongst the general public against the politicians, a lot of uncertainty over the next month, the next years, but it's not yet in a situation where the army needs to step into in a situation of emergency, a state of emergency, to keep up civil order. We are not there yet.
So we mustn't, think in terms of the 60s, for instance. You know, it's a different situation now.
Completely. I mean, if we remember what happened in the 60s, essentially the army stepped in to prevent the country from falling into the arms of communists, and it was in that supported by the CIA. So in a way, this is a completely different film. that we are watching now. I mean, there are no communists anymore. And for a starter, what would the army do with a bankrupt country? I mean, they can't do anything against bankruptcy. They are completely powerless in that situation. So in a way, it doesn't make any sense for them to step in. The only I would think the only scenario where you would have some kind of, you know, increased presence of the army would be if there is a complete break of civil order, you know, order, public order. Essentially, if the country defaults, it leaves the euro, there is a run on the banks, and everybody sort of goes crazy for a short period of time, sort of the Argentina scenario, then there could be a situation where the police is no longer capable of taking care of the situation. Therefore, just in any other sort of, you know, natural catastrophe, emergency situation, the army would step in to support the police and support the government, but not in a leadership role. This, I think, is just unimaginable. And if you looked at it, actually, most Greeks didn't read this move in any way like the international observers did. Most Greeks said, oh, this is the government trying to put its people, and trying to appoint its party friends, and that's not on. But nobody was worried about a potential coup in Greece.
But we on the outside looking in have to be careful, but you know what we are imagining and understanding. The place seems to be just utterly chaotic even now.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the things we see on TV seem like utter chaos, and it is strong stuff. I mean, the average citizen is probably quite angry, resigned, or you know, has these kind of feelings. But I mean, we shouldn't forget that at the same time, life continues even in Greece and even at this moment. Of course, we from the outside, we only see the square in front of Parliament where we have daily protests, general strikes, and people fighting and beating up the police. But I mean, we should remember that the rest of the country is trying to get on with their life, however difficult that might be.
And it seems to be extremely difficult. I don't know if you're in the prediction game, but watching Greece, it's very hard not to ask you. You know, we're hearing endless analysts talking about how, you know, even the financial solution that the EU dreamed up is a Band-Aid that was never going to hold, even if it does get to hold this time. Where is this going to end up for Greece?
What's quite interesting, actually, I think, in the whole context of Greece is that the Greek people are not really... they haven't been asked about any of this, and they haven't been able to express their opinion on any of this. Because if you remember, the Greek government that might be on its way out now was voted in 2009 on a mandate that they would spend their way out of the crisis. And that's why people voted for Papandreou, because he said, you know, cuts is the wrong answer. We will have state intervention, and that way we will save our economy. Well, for what he's doing now, and what he has been forced to do now, and what he continues to be forced by those people who are supporting him, is completely the opposite. It's basically cut everything that moves, and cut everything you can cut. And so in a way, now the idea to consult the people over this, in theory, is not a bad, I mean, it's not something, you know, outlandish. That's what you do in a democracy.
But then, of course, he changes his mind today and says, well, maybe not.
He came under immense pressure from the European leaders, because essentially the European leaders are not helping Greece because they love Greece so much, but because they're worried about the next in line, the next one in the firing line, which is Italy. So they are trying to preserve the euro and the integrity of the euro, and that's why they are helping Greece, and that's why they're forcing also Greece to adopt all of these debts. So in a way, you have to remember that essentially the Greek people are the subjects of all of these moves, be they supportive or not supportive, but they haven't had a chance to express themselves, which is partly why they go on the streets and protest, because that's the only thing they can do, and which is also why they might have wanted to vote in a referendum. But that was taken away from them now, because it was just too risky for the whole of the Eurozone.
Pepe Egger, I thank you very much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure.
And that was Pepe Egger of Exclusive Analysis. That is all from us here at Midori House. It's time to thank my producer, Jillian DeBias, and studio manager, Anna Veal. Nick Kelly will be here with the news in a moment, followed by The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. I'm Nancy Durham. Bye for now.